It's Saturday, March 11th, 2006, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of Public of California. Today's rundown, a bit of geek news, and your questions and comments about technology during the second half.
Geek Speak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on our program, we'll focus on some geek news and then invite your questions and comments of technology. We're opening up to anything, and that's during the second half in about a half an hour. And the phone numbers, if you want to jot them down now, 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, or you can contact us now, get in our queue by going to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. I'll give out that information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. GeekSpeak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation, and offering one-appointment crowns and veneers for appointments and more information, 423-2447. This is Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Miles Elam, technical trainer at Surf Control, and Sean Cleveland, technical marketing manager at NVIDIA. Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning.
I think, Miles, I'll start with you today. What's the first news item?
Well, a very important news item for me personally is that I finally got my best friend to listen to the show. So, hi, Alex.
Are we talking about Alex?
Yeah.
Oh, come on. He's listened before, hasn't he?
So, anyway, an individual by the name of Emilio Gonzalez, who is an amateur astronomer from Spain, was trying to do some research on craters.
As in
impact craters.
Okay.
Yeah, from meteorites. Mm-hmm. And checks out some areas with Google Earth, trying to map them off. And Google Earth, he found, within a couple of minutes, he located two craters. And then checking the records, you realize they were completely new. No one had ever tracked them before. So
he got to name them, kind of thing?
Well, it's rather along the lines of no one knew that they were really there before. He just happened to look at Google Earth, looking around at different satellite photos, and just happened to catch an area in the Sahara Desert that people had not seen before.
Okay, so it's in a desert. So that makes sense. So you have a lot of people, like, walking by it. I get that. I was kind of like, well, wouldn't you know if it's kind of in your backyard? Okay, that's cool. So does he get to name them, and what is he naming them?
I mean,
that's the important information.
Yeah, that I don't know.
Is his last name Troxell by chance? And I'm going to get it? No, not so much.
But at the same time, it's just, you have Google, which made this really cool technology of Google Earth. You have someone who is just doing something as a hobby, and then this new discovery just comes up just because of the sharing of information.
Google Earth is pretty cool. The first time I used it, I was playing with it for like hours on end. You guys the same way with Google Earth? Was it fun or boring?
It was interesting. It was fun, yeah.
But you haven't wasted hours like me?
No, not so much.
Thanks,
I spent too much time playing games. I mean, certain people make me play the game on a regular basis.
Google Earth is basically a mapping system that's a 3D map of the Earth. We've talked about it, I think, every show since it came out. It's a blast to play with. I'm assuming a Google search on Google Earth would discover the thing, and you can download it on your computer. It's free on, I think, both major platforms, but not on Linux. Okay, let's go to the next news item. Mr. Cleveland, hi, and welcome to GeekSpeak.
Good morning.
So what you got for us today?
Well, there was a lot of announcements this past week from CeBIT.
What's
which
CeBIT?
Is the world's largest computer show in Hanover, Germany. And then Intel had their developers forum in San Francisco. But, you know, nothing really seemed to catch my eye. I don't know. Maybe
you're like going through all these press releases and like, can't technology.
Yeah,
I'm
just looking at all these announcements and just more of the same, really. Faster, smaller.
They keep talking about computers. So doesn't it get old?
Well, let's take this for example. So Microsoft unveiled its origami project.
So they have paper now? What's the origami
project? So this is kind of a tablet PC. You know, like your notebook. Remember that the screen would flip around and sit down, and all of a sudden you have a tablet.
Like all those cool things on Star Trek.
It's pen-driven, and it was supposed to be very revolutionary, but nobody could care less. So Microsoft took that idea and shrunk it down a bit more into an ultra-mobile PC. This is what they're calling it, ultra-mobile PC. That's about, you know, the screen is 7 inches. It weighs less than 2 pounds. And it includes an optimized version of Windows XP that is touch-driven. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be better. So,
but we've seen these things. It's just kind of a slight modification of them.
Yeah, you know, from what I'm hearing, well, they look bulky.
Yeah.
You certainly couldn't fit in your pocket. You got to carry a bag for this.
Now, you had a tablet PC at your last job for quite a while.
And I never used it in tablet form.
Yeah.
So, these things, they look bulky. I hear they're heavy. They keep a charge of about 3.5 hours.
Not long enough.
They don't have a keyboard.
No keyboard?
No.
So it's like a giant Palm Pilot?
Yeah.
Forget it.
It's like a really oversized Palm Pilot that you hold sideways. And, of course, I guess they're going after the PSP, which is the PlayStation Portable.
Right, except for the PSP.
Those play games, but with this you can listen to music and you can watch movies, and it's smaller. You can fit it in your bag. If you want to check email, you can. If you want to respond to email...
It probably puts a keyboard display on the screen.
Maybe that's what happens, yeah.
Okay, so basically,
you know, and they cost close to a grand.
Two trade shows, and that's the most interesting thing that comes out of it. And
That's just a sample of the type of products that I was seeing. Nothing really caught my eye.
Yeah. And now, I'm assuming you didn't go to Hanover, Germany, because I would have known, or I would have remembered that you were gone for
a week. I was there for just a few hours, yeah.
Did you go to the San Francisco
show? You missed me over those 3 days traveling?
No, did you? Did you make it to the San Francisco show, the Intel?
I went to a dinner, so I had to drive up there last week to go to a special dinner with ECS, a motherboard manufacturer.
And was that something you can talk about?
A bunch of press there, and the talk was about Conroe.
What's Conroe?
Conroe is the second coming for Intel.
It could I'm sorry, be. What?
There's a child? So is this an evil thing?
You know what? I didn't say that.
Okay.
I'm telling you what I heard an Intel representative say. He said, all praise Conroe. It's going to save Intel. He thanked God for the engineers in Israel.
Well, thank goodness, you know, Intel doesn't have their marketing arm talking about this.
Yeah.
So Conroe is the next generation Core.
Core processor.
And it's going to be called Core, funny enough. Conroe is... So remember when they couldn't get any performance out of the Pentium 4,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
So
they went back to the
Pentium 3, and they made that a... Because it was low power. They made that a... You know, a notebook chip that was, they renamed the Pentium M, became part of Centrino, that became part of Core. And this technology now, that Core, is moving forward. And what they're finding is it's quite the performer. So 6 months ahead of launch, they let Anontech.com and Hexus.net editors
play.
Actually sit down and benchmark this processor 6 months ahead of launch. We're not going to see this till September, October timeframe. And they overclocked AMD's fastest processor, the FX60, because the next generation, the next launch is going to be FX62,
right.
Supposedly. It hasn't been announced yet.
So it'll be similar to that.
And it'll use DDR2 memory and so on. But anyway, they're trying to get today's fastest, you know, competitive processor. They did benchmarks. They allowed these editors to do benchmarks with Conroe, and Conroe outperformed it by 20%.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's
after
huge.
It was overclocked.
No. The AMD processor was overclocked.
That's what I mean, like after the AMD processor was overclocked.
Wow. Okay,
of course, the whole tech community just stood up and said, well, what? And there must be something wrong. You did this on Intel systems. Obviously they're cheating. The BIOSes are,
right.
You know, are fixed or whatever. And Anontech went back in and checked everything out thoroughly and said, no, everything seems to be,
Wow, AMD
okay
must
here,
be
so.
Sweating it.
Well, Intel must be sweating it. If they're allowing editors to come in and benchmark a processor that wouldn't be a launch for 6 months, they've lost so much market share.
Yeah.
enthusiasts don't use Intel chips. They just don't perform.
So, right. But in 6 months, that might change.
Well, that's what everyone's hoping. But of course, you know, AMD's got 6 months to come up with something.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. Like, own, so what's the processor for AMD in 6 months, assuming they're being more
AMD
secretive?
Says they don't need to have a response to this. They're not worried.
Yeah, because when the processor comes out, they'll have a response in hardware. All right,
so
well,
anyway, that was kind of the big, you know, news this past week, Conroe. We'll see.
It must be kind of interesting moving from, I mean, at once.
That's the code name, Conroe.
Conroe. You were at AMD for, you know, worked for AMD for quite a while, and you were very much, you know, knowing what AMD was doing. Then you moved into a kind of a competitor, AMD, another mobile hardware processor company. And now you moved into a company that works really detailed with AMD and Intel.
Yeah.
Must be a very different location for you to be in. You really get to see them from an outsider's perspective, but at a very detailed level.
So I guess for people who don't know, I work at NVIDIA. I work on the Inforce chip. Inforce is a motherboard chipset that supports both AMD and Intel.
So you really know that
our market is huge on the AMD side. Enthusiasts, they all want Athlon 64 and the FX processors. And the Intel side, they're just there's no enthusiast buying that right now because it just doesn't perform for games.
All right, let's.
But we'll see what happens. This may change things. This may give Intel back the crown. You know.
So. Yeah. Definitely. Okay, and you do have you also have Intel chipset support as well at NVIDIA.
Oh, yeah.
All right, thank you, Sean, for that cool update on what's going on with the processor giants. Miles, story?
There's a new animal that's been discovered. I mean, people...
Was it hiding in a crater?
Biologists have come out and said, like, we found a new species you know, X, Y, or Z. Something is really odd. It's a new genus, you know. Well, some divers in the South Pacific have discovered a new crustacean that looks like a furry lobster.
What?
That is so different from...
It looks like a stuffed animal.
I thought it was
a stuffed animal.
No, I mean, literally, it looks like hair. It looks like fur.
Wait, a crustacean with fur? It must not be fur, though. Because that's a little different for crustaceans to have hair.
Well, it's a sinuous hair-like strand. But I mean, it does look like a fuzzy, as Sean mentioned.
What color?
It's an off-white.
Okay.
And it's blind.
Well, it's low-light environment, sure.
Yeah, and it is so distinct from anything else that we've come across that it's not just a new species, not just a new genus, it's not just a new order, it's a completely new family of animals.
Really? No, okay. That's pretty low on the tree breakup of species or of creatures. So it's going to define a whole new sub. It's like the platypus, just like totally new, totally weird, doesn't fit kind of thing.
Well, yeah.
So, that's cool. What's it called?
It is known as, excuse me one moment, as I scroll down here. Well, the family name is Kiwaita.
Kiwaita.
Yeah, okay. From Kiwa, the goddess of crustaceans in Polynesian mythology.
Yes, there's a goddess of crustaceans. Rad.
Well, if you live in,
if you
know,
live
the
in
South Pacific, crustaceans would probably be more.
Yeah.
Or if you're surrounded by water, waterborne creatures are.
How long are they from tip to tip?
It's white and it's about 15 centimeters long, about the size of a salad plate.
Yeah.
Sorry, I just reading.
Wait
from
a second,
the,
is someone going to eat it?
I saw that on my salad. I'd scream like a girl.
We'll have to throw that up on the site, the link.
Sean, you always scream like a girl. Like,
shut up, Miles.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Miles, for that. Mr. Cleveland, you got anything to scream about?
Well, something to be concerned about. The Seventh Circuit United States Appeals Court has ruled that employees cannot unlawfully delete their computers, notebooks.
The content on the computers.
The content on computers before handing them back to their employees.
Employers.
Yeah. I see. Okay.
So if you're an employee of a company and you've got a company notebook and you're using it for other things and you delete that data, if the company is aware that something's going on and the data's not on that notebook, they could have a case against you.
Oh, well, if they suspect. That's what...
Well, yeah, where'd the proof come, though?
The company... Well, so this is what happened. There's a guy. I'm not going to get into the whole who it was and what happened.
Right.
But anyway, this guy was employed by a company called Citrin, and he had been doing his work, but he was doing his side work, too. It has to do with the real estate and so on. The company had found out that he was doing this stuff, and I guess he got canned, and they... expected to find incriminating evidence on his notebook, and he used secure delete software to wipe it. And he gave the notebook back, and that company took him to court and said, "You can't do that. That's our data. It's on our notebook." And the court said, "That's correct."
Interesting. Now, I wonder if he had just deleted the stuff that was, you know, personally his rather than the entire machine, or if that was the issue.
Doesn't matter.
It's not his
notebook. So,
well, yeah.
So any data on that notebook, yeah.
They own. Interesting.
There was a little bit to it in that he signed a 2-year non-compete clause, and he was looking at going into business for himself in a related field.
Yeah.
So the company did have some reason to believe that there might be something in there. However, they were filing under a federal suit or federal law that prohibits destroying or damaging.
So that was evidence, basically, and so that was the argument.
But at the same time, is deleting a file damaging company hardware?
Interesting. Well, I mean, it is damaging information. It's destroying information, and if you think of that as property of the company, I mean, I see the argument. I think it's an interesting case.
But
it makes me nervous about
the appeals court decision basically reverses a lower court ruling that allows this lawsuit to continue, so the company can sue.
See, the thing that makes no sense to me to some degree is that if I'm surfing the web on my company machine, maybe on at lunchtime or something, and I go across a site that happens to be something that I've logged in, like my bank account information on Wells Fargo or something, right? I've logged in. All that information is cached on the machine. It's on this hard drive. If I leave that day and decide to leave the company and I erase my web cache because it has that private information, could I be infringing upon
this? I don't think you really need to worry about that so much. This is more about the company knows that you're doing something else with its property, mm-hmm. or you're competing with the company, or you're being, let's say, investigated, or you've been fired or something, and they want to get that data from you, maybe to use it against you in court. If they found that you've tampered with that, the court's not going to protect you.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of what this is saying.
Right. Yeah.
Except for the whole, they have a strong suspicion, and they have reasonable knowledge behind this, except that there is no proof. Like, it's saying, we suspect that they had information that he got rid of, but
there's no proof, correct?
Right. There's no way to actually say, hey, look, there's this deleted file, because it has been deleted.
So the burden of proof is on the company, but the courts have stepped back and said, well, here, go for it. Right. We're not protecting the employee.
And taking a step back, just to delete a file won't remove it from the hard drive. It just removes a reference to it. The data is still there, so someone could recover it. What this person used was a piece of software that will not only delete the file, but overwrite those bits over and over again.
Over and over, yeah, making
so that
it very
it can't
difficult.
Be, yeah, yeah, so it cannot be recovered.
But, supposedly the government has tools that can recover data from any disk.
Well, after you overwrite the same area 6 times, really security experts believe that you can't get it back.
Okay. 6 times. That's the magic number. Okay, Miles.
okay.
Let's go on to another. Let's talk about, SiteAdvisor, because that's cool. What's SiteAdvisor?
Okay, there's a site called SiteAdvisor. So it was brought up to me by a coworker.
SiteAdvisor.com.
Yes. And it's a plugin for Internet Explorer and Firefox. And coming across it, for me, as someone who had done web development, when I see a site that looks odd, and I also, use browsers and techniques to keep myself safer than maybe the average person. When I see a site that looks a little bit odd, I'll know it better than the average person because I have done web development. I've seen it from the other side. I'll see, that looks odd. Why would they do it that way? Ah, there's something nefarious going on. But the general public does not necessarily have the knowledge I have, an area knowledge, as it were. That's where SiteAdvisor.com comes into play, is that it's a plugin for IE and Firefox that when you do, for example, a Google search, it will list a green check mark, a yellow exclamation point, or a red X, depending upon the threat level of that item. In other words, if that site's going to send you a whole bunch of spam if you give them their email address, or if they are trying to download spyware, it'll show up with a red X, and you'll know at a glance from a Google response or a Yahoo search that you're not supposed to click on that. it's going to be a bad idea.
If you go to that site, it's a bad place. So it's basically, it makes your browsing experience kind of, you're aware of it prior to getting there. And for people that don't know what to look for on these kind of evildoers, it lets you know with a simple icon. I like it. I'm a little concerned about the algorithm behind detecting what's bad and what's good. Like, what if there's a site that has wonderful data, it's the only place that has that wonderful information, and has a red X because of something it has on the site. There's kind of this, you know.
But you're still making an informed decision.
Yes.
That's
what
the
it's
difference.
About, right?
It's not stopping you from going to the site. What it's showing you is the red X. You put the mouse over the red X, and you'll see, for example, I just typed in whatever to Google. And most of the returns from that search are a green checkbox.
I put in furry lobster.
But there is a site, and I'm going to mention a site that you should not go to.
Don't go here.
Yeah, don't go here. I mean, I'm serious, folks. Don't go here. this is not a joke. You know, this is not a...
Get on with it, Miles. Okay.
www.lunarpages.com. And it shows up
with
a red X. No, don't go there. And I'm putting my cursor over this red X, and it says it links to other possibly bad sites.
And that's the problem?
Right. And so I can say, well, maybe I just won't click on any links after I go there.
Cool. So you know if it's safe to actually visit that page.
And I can click on more information in a little pop-up box.
So click on that link, and then see the links on those pages. Your browser's about to crash.
Then click on another one and tell me what happened.
No, yeah, rather, exactly. from that
drop your computer from waist height.
From that little dialog box that comes up saying that here is the reason why, you can click on a more link.
Oh.
And it will take you to a siteadvisor.com. Page that describes what sites it's pointing to and what their status is, like whether they are a danger or not.
Oh, wow. And it even has things like how many emails per month.
Right. And yes, it'll say, for example, will this site spam you if you give them their email, give you your
email
address?
It even gives you like a branch tree of like where it links to, what other sites. This is
right. The best way I can describe it is if you just want to browse websites and you're using Internet Explorer or Firefox, you should get this because it will tell you when something is harmful or not in an easy to understand way, in a way that it doesn't require that you be a geek.
I also noticed that I went to one of these pages, and does it actually show up with next to all the does this green checkbox show up on all the pages with every link? No, it doesn't.
No,
so it's kind of nice. It just modifies the search engine.
It's just the search engines, but every page that you go to, there will be a little icon in the bottom right-hand corner.
Dude,
called
the furry lobster is amazing looking. It's an albino. Yeah, it looks like a tick or something. It's a trip. Anyway, siteadvisor.com, if you want to try this thing out, works on Internet Explorer and Firefox, and it allows you to be a more intelligent surfer.
Right.
Safer and all that.
SiteAdvisor keeps you safer.
All right. Got another minute before the break. Sean?
So some MIT developers are working on carbon nanotube ultracapacitors to replace batteries. So, it gets pretty technical. A capacitor is something that holds a charge and quickly releases it, kind of like a camera flash, right? Well, ultracapacitor is obviously something that holds more. compared to lithium-ion batteries, which can store 100 to 150 watt-hours per kilogram.
Okay.
These things currently only store 5 to 6. Not much, really.
All right.
They're hoping to get these things to 60 watt-hours per kilogram. And this could be the next generation.
These are great because it's just an electrical storage medium. It's not a chemical storage medium like a battery. And battery chemical storage mediums, you have all these problems about battery memory. You have these problems. A lot of things happen with it.
Well,
capacitors are very clean.
Capacitor is just, you know, two pieces of conductive material separated by an insulator to store the electricity.
And what happens is you have these two plates that are really close to each other, and electrons pile up on one side and holes or lack of electrons pile up on the other side, so you get a charge on it. And this is why opening a television after it's been unplugged is still dangerous, because there's capacitors.
They hold the charge.
And there's these like little mini toys, like little tiny mini cars that you charge really fast and let go. Those have capacitors. And the capacitor technology has been increasing. I can see why nanotubes would really add
so
another layer.
So really cool, you know. If they can get 60 watt hours per kilogram, that's pretty amazing. Won't be as powerful as a lithium ion battery, but this is really cool. They can be recharged in just a few minutes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they can withstand up to 300,000 discharge cycles.
Right, so they can just be used over and over. Oh,
the problem right now is if you go to eBay and you want to buy some carbon nanotubes, they cost about 20,000 per kilogram.
That's so expensive. That's more expensive than gold.
So, yeah, it could be a while.
All right, thanks for that news break, guys. GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Felton offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. Okay. Last night, it was hailing in Santa Cruz, and today, there's warnings of things that are coming. So we'll do those now, and I'll start with Mr. Elam. What's going on with the surf, man?
San Francisco and Monterey Bays, high surf warning remains in effect until noon today. Large northwesterly swell continues to impact the California coast. Sea heights locally reaching 20 feet will continue through midday today before slowly starting to subside. High surf warning indicates that dangerous battering waves will pound the shoreline. This will result in very dangerous swimming conditions and deadly rip currents. Boaters traveling in the water or people going to the beaches this weekend are advised to take precautions.
And this is an official warning. And I will invite people to call in now with questions and comments. We get them in the queue, and then we'll hear about what's happening tonight. What's happening with the snow. Our phone numbers to call in and ask us technical questions and comments about technology are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Rick Fillman, our web geek and phone answerer, is standing by ready to take your calls with questions and comments. 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Or you can go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us.
To go with Miles' previous announcement.
Sure.
High surf, and this is the snow warning. Snow advisory remains in effect until 4 p.m. today. Numerous showers and thunderstorms will continue to move onshore through Saturday afternoon. Snow levels will remain near 1,000 feet, with snow possible at sea level in heavier showers, as we saw last night. Roadways above 1,000 feet will likely become snow or slush covered and slippery. Roadways in our area that can be affected include Skyline Road, which is Highway 35, Mount Hamilton, Highway 17, Empire Grade Road, Bonnie Dune.
Great. Thank you very much for that. Important announcement about safety. This program is supported by Cruise.io, providing local and nationwide internet services, including DSL 6.0, spam filters, and virus protection. Information about Cruise.io membership is available online at Cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. And that was Cruise.io.com. It sounded like one word there. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air is Miles Elam and Sean Cleveland. And we are taking your calls and questions and comments about technology. Get in the queue now. Oh, there's a few lines open. Phone numbers, again, 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Mr. Elam.
At KOSP.org, you can find the commentaries that KOSP airs on First Person Singular each Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can also find information on how you can submit commentary for First Person Singular on KUSP.org.
First Person Singular is a great show. It's views and opinions of people in this area, recording them, voicing them, and it's one of those wonderful connections that KOSP does with community. I always like listening to them. When we came in this morning, there's a whole bunch of people get kind of queued up from UCSC students who've written papers in the English department, and then we're recording them on air for First Person Singular. Really great show, and it comes up all the time, and you can learn more information about getting involved and when it's on at kosp.org, as Miles just said. Okay, we're going to start getting into the calls because they're coming in, and that's what we're here for. And now the board looks totally blank. No, okay, we're good. We got some calls. That's like the nightmare you have as a host. We're cutting calls now, and no, we're not. All right, first person, hello, and welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi there.
Hi.
I got a question about DVD burning.
DVD burning, okay.
I just bought an external DVD burner, a Lite-On SHW1635SX or something like this.
Yes, I know the model. No, I'm just kidding.
I don't have it in front of me. I'm in the car. So.
I hope you're not driving while we're talking. Okay, so what's the question?
I'm on speakerphone. It's okay. Basically, I have a problem with what file format to export my movie in so that I can burn it onto that burner. And I want to be able to throw that in a DVD player.
Okay, one more time.
So I've got a movie in Windows Movie Maker. I tried it in that, and I tried it in Nero. And I want to export it in the right file format to burn it onto the player, onto a DVD disc, or I don't know, whichever, minus R. And it's not letting me do that. For some reason, it says
you're having
a problem.
Which file format is the source movie in? Is it a .avi or .quicktime?
Did you catch that?
Yeah, we got you, no problem. Oh, I see. Sorry, Sean, go ahead.
Can you hear us now? We're talking, but obviously the board was...
It was just your mic, but go on, Sean.
Okay, so what file format is the source movie in? Is it QuickTime or .avi?
No, it was... It came out as an MPEG.
Okay.
So what recorded the MPEG?
What recorded the MPEG?
Yeah, how did you create
that? I had a digital video camera.
So to play it on your DVD player, you'll need to convert it to MPEG 2.
And you have Nero?
I do have Nero, yeah. Express.
Oh, Nero Express. Because the full version of Nero has Nero Showtime, which is a great piece of software for converting file formats into a recognizable format for your DVD player.
You can get really good, Sean is good at this because he's been doing DVD burning for so long that he knows the formats and everything, to actually encode the file specifically so that it will then be able to burn onto a DVD. But the way to do it the easiest way is to find DVD burning software that re-encodes right before it burns the disc. So it's kind of a double... whammy. You know, first it looks at the video, re-encodes it to exactly what it wants, kind of caches it, and then it burns the DVD.
Yep.
It takes a long time, especially if you know what you're doing, you can just store the file. So, Nero Express does not have that. I don't know of any free ones that do that.
You know what? Go to doom9.net.
Okay. Did you say
Doom?
Doom.
Yep. doom9.net. Go to the download section and you'll find so many free tools for doing this sort of a thing.
And what will be the format that I want to end up in? Because I thought with Nero Express I was actually putting it in DVD format. I selected that before I exported it to a file.
Uh-huh.
And I think it still came out as MPEG, which I was confused by.
MPEG is the right format, actually.
MPEG 2, though.
MPEG 2 is the right format for most... If you want compatibility with most DVD players.
Right.
Some DVD players will play other types of MPEG formats, but... MPEG 2 is kind of large.
So I wouldn't be surprised, though, if you put... So when it tries to burn... You burn the DVD successfully with this file on it?
No, I'm having trouble even getting the DVD burner to recognize
it. So first off, this is a complicated issue, but in Nero Express, one of the solutions is to make a DVD. DVD for playing. It's not a data DVD, it's a video DVD.
Right.
And when you create that, it's going to be two different folders. It's going to be like video_TS or something similar to that. You need to put the file inside that subfolder. If you don't, it will not work.
Okay, all right. So I can play around with that.
Those are our two suggestions for you. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I wanted to ask him another question.
Why don't you ask him now? Hey, I'm just kidding. I hung up on him. Sorry.
It sounded like he was having problems just burning in general.
Yeah, he might have been. No, I'm just kidding.
When I get DVD players, it's kind of advanced, but I go off and look for a firmware update.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of times,
things change. What kind of broken, right?
Yeah, so something to think
about. So you basically take a look at whatever manufacturer made it.
Go to the manufacturer's website, go to the support section, put in the model number, and see if there are any updates for that drive.
And then they'll download a little application normally, and you run that, and it uploads the firmware, which is basically like the BIOS of the hardware.
Oh, what a pain.
Yeah, but it's really useful. I remember when we got some DVD burners one time from Plextor. They were cutting edge. They were shipping us stuff before it was hitting the market because we were pressed and such. And it wasn't working. They were really difficult. You upload the firmware, and all of a sudden, it sped up the burn process, and it's a lot better. So it's a good thing to do.
The standards change all the time, and they're trying to support future standards,
right?
DVD burning.
I mean, they release hardware before the standards even pinned down.
Yeah. And even the discs, all of the dies are proprietary, and nobody wants to pay royalties on those, so they make up their own dies,
right?
Which, then the drives have to become compatible with those. The only way to get that compatibility is to update your firmware.
It's like it's complicated or something. Okay, so we're going to go on to the next next person. From Santa Cruz, Walter, welcome to Geek Speak. Hello, Walter.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning. Welcome.
I downloaded a Norton antivirus program on a trial basis, and now I don't want to renew it, and they won't let me remove it, using the add remove section.
Sure.
Is there anything else I can do?
Yeah, they probably have their own removal tool. So
excuse me?
They should have their own removal tool. If you go to the folder where it's installed, so if you go to Start, Programs, then you look for Norton, in there... There should be a way to remove
This is not uncommon. So the removal tool that's part of the operating system, you know, you go into systems and it says remove hardware and software.
In the control panel.
In the control panel, which is what you're using.
Right.
That does certain things. It cleans up your system. It removes stuff. But the truth of the matter is with virus protection, it's got to do some really crazy things on your computer to make you safe. It like gets into the operating system, if you will, kind of insidiously. And that's actually one of the reasons why virus protection software lots of times will slow your computer down. There's a lot of side effects. It's what needs to happen to make your computer safe because Microsoft's operating system is so
You might
messy.
Need to reboot several times during the uninstall process.
Because of this complexity, the install script and the removal script are more complicated than normal. And therefore, you can't use Microsoft's remove software as easily. Now, I'm kind of making all this up because I haven't actually had a lot of problems with this, but I would recommend exactly what Sean is saying.
Yeah.
Go to the directory that it's installed, and you can probably get that by start, program files,
all programs,
Norton.
Then look for the Norton folder. In there where you would normally launch Norton from, there should be a way to uninstall it.
Now, if that doesn't work, it's going to be somewhere on your machine. And one way to go that is go into the C drive and then go into programs and go into Norton. And you might find more things in there, and one of them might be uninstall. So that's what I recommend.
Go to program file and then to Norton?
Or put in your original install disk, and there should be a removal tool. That disk.
If you've got a disk, that's a good way to go.
It should recognize you have a copy installed.
And I personally like free AVG. It's a free solution. They don't ever charge you, and it's got good updates, and it seems to run pretty well on a Windows machine.
Working great for me. Yeah.
So good luck on that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, that was Walter, and now we're going to go Watsonville. Arnold, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hello?
Hello, Arnold. What's up?
Yeah, hi. I'm trying to figure out a way to run my desktop computer on a 12-volt battery, but without using an inverter.
Rad! I love it. Okay, are you on a boat or a trailer or what?
Well, I'm living off the grid, kind of up in the hills, and I don't have a whole PV system set up yet. But
well, completely doable. I mean, there's a couple things that are a little complex. First off, you've only got a positive line voltage from your battery. And your computer actually, I believe... Well, Sean, do you know if a motherboard needs a negative 12 volts or is it only positive 12 volts and negative 5? Come on, you should know this, man.
I'm not an engineer.
But you know people at work that answer this question, right?
Oh, I'm sure.
Okay, pick up your cell phone. Let's find out. No. So it's going to be more complicated than we'd like it. For example, your computer actually needs minus 5 volts. I'm not sure if it needs a minus 12. It needs a plus 12. It needs a minus 5. It needs a plus 5. And it might need some other voltages, but nothing above 12. So you can do this, but I would definitely get an off-the-shelf model, unless, of course, you're like an electrical engineer and can do this yourself. In which case, that'd be kind of cool, and you should sell the product. But, yeah, totally doable. I mean, I think about this all the time. We have all these power supplies. Sean's always kind of handing me off good power supplies to plug in. And you're going from 110 volts AC down to a whole bunch of DC voltage, which is in the 12-volt range. And it's like, that's harder to go from, like, a 12-volt battery, especially in cars. You know, you see this all the time where you'll take your computer, like a laptop, for example, which only needs 20 volts. There's different things that it needs. It would be easier to go without the inverter, but it seems to be that everything's set up for 110 in this country, so that's what happens.
Some of the more compact cases, the mini ATX, nano ATX, will have a external power brick.
Yeah.
So the actual input going to the computer is DC.
Yeah.
It's the power brick that does the inversion. So that may work out for it.
Okay,
well, I have the power supply for my computer in my hand right now, and it does say it goes from AC input to DC output 12 volts. And then the current is minus 5 volts, minus 12 volts.
Okay, so you need so basically it's saying that wouldn't be the current. That's current's not voltage, current's amperage. But we won't get into that. But it sounds to me like, I mean, the thing is, it's totally doable to do this, and there is definitely a market because there are a lot of people who live off the grid. The best example of that is boats, the boat industry in general.
Mm-hmm.
You try not to run 110 inside your boat. Now, if it's a large enough boat, you do. I'm assuming that we have listeners that know this answer and can give us a call and let us know, and I welcome you to do that. In fact, the lines are open right now to some degree. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. I invite anybody to call in with questions and comments, and if you can answer this question of Arnold on how do you run a normal desktop computer, basically a power supply that uses a 12 volt in rather than 110 volts. We'd love to know the answer. And you can call us with any comments or questions in technology. We're here to help. 476-2800, toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Arnold, I'm assuming you got internet access. I would definitely get to a point where you have internet access and do some Google searching on this. You're going to find this. It's a product that's out there.
Yeah,
and if
I
not,
did.
You and I should make millions.
I haven't been that lucky yet. I found things for laptops. You know,
yeah.
It's easy to do with a laptop.
So what term should he search under, Lyle?
Yeah, that's the part I'm not knowing. I'm going to hope that we get somebody that calls in with the exact answer to this, or someone that can Google this. It's really 12-volt power supply. Yeah, but you're going to get other things.
Pretty interesting, though.
12-volt computer power supply. Yeah, maybe somebody will Google it and let us know. Good luck, Arnold. I definitely stay tuned, and I'm sure that we'll be able to answer this. And if not, send us an email, and I'll do some more research.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Arnold.
Bye.
Bye-bye. All right, now we're going to go to Scotts Valley. Cool. Scotts Valley, Anya? Anno?
Hello.
How do you pronounce your name?
I think I'll be Anonymous.
Okay. Anonymous. Oh, that's what the abbreviation is.
That's right.
Anonymous it is. From Scotts Valley. Welcome.
Okay, here's the issue. I have I do big CAD drawings, and I had a drawing, I think there's about 600 files in it. And it represents about 3 weeks of work. And what I normally do is I back everything up on a flash drive.
Mm-hmm.
And so, anyway, I was doing that, and I dragged it into the flash drive, and the file was too big. There wasn't enough room on the flash drive, so it didn't finish copying over. But it did ask me if I wanted to replace the old one, and I said yes. And then I realized it didn't fit, so I went to drag the incomplete file out and throw it in the recycling bin and empty it and do it over again. And then I realized I dragged it out of the wrong window, and I actually dragged the original into the recycle bin and erased it.
And so the prompt that said, should we erase the old one and make enough space, you said yes to erasing it from the flash drive, the old backup. And then the new one, you actually threw the wrong one away. All right, and you erased the trash. Right. Are you on a Windows machine?
Yes, XP.
How recently did you do this?
I did it yesterday, late at night.
All right, first off, have you done a lot of work today on the computer?
I haven't touched it since I did it.
Sweet. Sean, how do we solve this problem?
God, you know, it's funny. I just hit a site that talked about all these free tools for doing this.
Find it. And we're going to get this in just a minute. There are tools that do undelete. And basically,
there are some great ones out there that recover data from a worse date than that if you'd been working on the computer. Yeah. Sometimes you can get that back.
But what is this file?
This should be really easy.
Is this a folder or a file?
Well, it was a folder with about 600 files in it.
And what are the files?
What are they? They're CAD files.
CAD files. Okay. Yeah, it's going to... So basically what happens is when you erase stuff from a drive, what's actually happening is the lookup portion of the drive erases that entry. So now the computer thinks that space is reusable. So as you use your computer, that space will be rewritten with other things. And that's why I ask how recently. So you don't want to do a lot of activity on the drive. And now one of the problems, of course, is that you're going to have to get software that will then go and try to find these files for you and undelete them. And
it's got to do it without installing it on the computer.
That's right. So you are probably going to lose some of these files on your local machine. But you also have a copy on your flash drive. And the flash drive, you haven't done any writing to since that was erased. So it should be okay. So basically you're going to get a software that goes and scans and looks at the opening and closure. It looks at the file and looks for a CAD file and understands what a CAD file is and tries to find the beginning and end of CAD files and remake a file. You're going to lose the file names. So all these files are going to be just random files. And that's going to be one of the things that's going to be really frustrating for you, especially with so many of them. But I think it's doable and you can find this. And if you want to make sure that this problem is handled the right way and it's really important to you, like this is your life's blood's effort kind of thing, what you want to do is take this right now to a company that will do this for you. If you want to risk it, it should probably be okay, you can do it yourself.
If it's a deleted file on a working system, you should be able to find some free tools out there that allow you to recover. Especially a lot of the free software, they put limits on the number of files you can delete and the size of those files. How big is this file, by the way?
Well, it's a directory of multiples.
If it didn't fit on a USB, how big is the USB?
It's about 1.7 gigs.
You're going to need to buy one.
Oh, that's a big USB stick you've got. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a 2-gig stick.
Yeah, that might... So, I'm not finding the link I wanted to.
You know what? We want to help you on this, and unfortunately, don't have the time to do the searching for it on air, and it's the perfect solution is to find one of these products.
I'm trying to find something that's free that works, but there are a ton of software out there, data recovery software. And you could just do a Google search on data recovery software.
But don't do a lot of Google searching. And actually, your cache is probably going to be safe for you. But you know what? I would just, because it's an important thing, I would just go ahead and find one that seems to have a good company behind it and buy the product. Don't spend over $40.
Okay.
I mean, it depends on how much this data is worth to you. Like, if this is the most important thing in your life, unplug your computer and take this to somebody, because they will recover it and you'll know it.
Like, there's from GetData, there's recovermyfiles.com. They have, you can download the software and run it. It'll go off and find the files that were deleted. So you'll know if you can recover the file or not before you purchase it. That's kind of cool. They should all give you that kind of, you know, they should all do that sort of a thing. You shouldn't have to buy the software first and then find out that it's not going to work for you. So, you know, that's probably the way to go. I think you can do this yourself. Just find some software. The file was deleted. You haven't really messed with the system since then. Do you have your hard drive partitioned?
No.
Yeah. See, if it was partitioned, then you could install the software on the other partition. You wouldn't have to worry about stepping on the file that was deleted. That's one of the problems.
Is there some that works off a CD where you don't have to install it?
Yeah.
You know, yeah, I'm sure there are.
It's a good question. I'm sure there are. I'm not thinking of anything.
Yeah, sorry. I'm sorry. We're not going to be able to help this. Help more than that on air.
Okay.
Good luck with your problem. I hope you find out.
Well,
if you do find a good solution, we'd love to hear what it was.
All right.
You know, send us an email. Go to our website and click on geekspeak.org, and send us an email. Give me your email address, and maybe I can help you find something.
Of course, we will maintain your anonymousness to the public. Of course, we'll have to know if your email address. But thank you and good luck. I hope this works out.
All right. Thank you.
Bye bye. I've lost JPEG files and couldn't find a free solution, so I wrote one myself. But it doesn't work for everything. It only worked for JPEGs. And it works pretty well, and I use it all the time when I lose JPEGs, but I don't know a good free product, and that's the issue.
You're losing JPEGs all the time?
I find that Sony memory sticks on Sony cameras seems to not be so stable. Maybe it was the earlier versions, maybe I got an older card. Mm-hmm. And there's one card that I've got that I keep on using that I shouldn't, and that's what's going on. Pacific Grove, Diane, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi.
Hi.
This is a girl kind of thing. I just two things. I wanted to put in a good word for iCams and keeping up with relatives and friends and that sort of thing.
Cool.
I have a good friend in Mexico, and she and I have Macintoshes, and we do an iCam almost every day, two or three times a week, and they're wonderful. And I have a niece in New Zealand who has
And I believe you called in before about this exact same.
I did, and that's why I'm calling in to tell you that it worked.
Which solution?
She has a PC, I have a Mac, we both have webcams, and we couldn't figure out how to both see and talk, you know, at the same time, have a chat and see each other, because the stuff wasn't good, you know, the platforms weren't compatible and stuff. So the workaround was to get on the iCam on Yahoo Messenger and then talk on Skype. And, you know, it's not a perfect solution. You do feel kind of like you're in a spaceship because the cam is so jerky. But it does work. You know, it works well enough for now, and I'm sure it's something that will be better in the future. But
hey, you know, can I say that I think that was my suggestion, right?
I think it was, yes.
We, you know, 5 years, we actually got one right, you guys. I'm really excited.
Not bad.
You know, 3 days after we did this with you, Sean and I wanted to do the exact same thing. I'm on a Mac. He's on a Windows machine. We spent the whole night working on it. I think we got that same solution working, but only halfway.
Yep.
So you beat us to it, and congratulations, and thank you for letting us know. I really appreciate it.
Hang in there, and it's a real good way to keep in touch with friends and family who are halfway around the world. So
thank you very much, Diane.
Say it again, what she did.
Okay, so what's happening is she's on a Mac and a Windows, and there's another Windows person.
Yep.
And all the solutions for doing video two-way with voice only work on Mac to Mac or only work on Windows to Windows.
Yep.
So there is a webcam solution that has no audio that's part of Yahoo Messenger. So it's the same solution we did, but we had some problems with it. You install Yahoo Messenger on both computers with webcams, and you start that up, and now you guys can see each other. And then you go to Skype. And you make a phone call.
So why couldn't we get your camera to work?
I don't know. Maybe I'm just broken.
So Lyle's got a Apple.
And you know, I thought about that after the fact. I found and I understand that some of the protocols inside a Mac for doing that kind of work has uses the same port as PostgreSQL's communication port, and I was running PostgreSQL server, so it might have been a conflict in that, which I've seen before. We do, you know, a great way to communicate is radio. We asked just a minute ago about a solution for a 12-volt computer, and of course Dennis heard us and called in. Dennis, in Santa Cruz Harbor?
Yes.
Welcome to Geekspeak. What's the solution?
There is a commercially available product, and unfortunately I'm right now going through my Mozilla bookmarks trying to find it, and I'm not finding it. But there is a company that makes a 12-volt power supply for a computer that would replace the 115-volt.
See, we knew one existed. Good. Okay.
Yeah. The only problem with it that I remember from looking at the webpage was that it's only a 150-watt power supply.
That's pretty minimal.
Well, what it means is that if you have some of the higher-powered Pentium 4 products, you may be in a marginal power situation. You may have to limit what you put on the power supply in terms of hard drives and DVD burners and things like that.
Let me ask you, you do live on the harbor?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're on. What do you do for your computer use?
We're hooked up to the power.
Yeah.
We run on power.
I see.
But, typically what people in these situations do is run an inverter.
Yeah.
And make very sure that you use an inverter that is a true sine wave inverter, because that will get you the right kind of power for your computer.
Well, Dennis, thank you very much for calling us and letting us know. I appreciate it.
The real problem isn't the computer, however, it's the monitor. And you won't be able to run a regular CRT-type monitor very long on an inverter, because they really chew up power. But
yeah, definitely true. So
some of the flat screens run on 12 volts, so the problem solved.
Thank you so much for the call.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
We're going to only be able to take one more call because of our timeline. We're going to go to Watsonville for Marianne. What's your question, Marianne?
Hi. I have kind of two questions. Mm-hmm. I am just about ready to buy a new computer, and I want a little advice. I'm debating between a Mac and a PC. I don't want to do games. The one thing I do want to do, my retirement project in a couple of years, is to put my movies that go back to the 40s, my old family movies, on DVDs so that I can share them with my family, and I don't know if there's a good way to do that. What would be the minimums for a computer to do that? I don't understand the video card thing when I'm, reading the specs, and I don't really understand about the chips. I understand about memory and hard drive.
What you're asking is relatively complicated. The problem is you need some kind of video in source, and it's like a video capture device. So I would go, if you're on a Windows machine, I'd go with like Windows, like a home media solution, Windows computer.
Uh-huh.
And if you're on a Macintosh, you're going to have to get a video in source, probably a breakout box. It won't actually come with the computer. Unfortunately, that's as much as I'm going to be able to answer to you today. If you'd like to send us an email, I'll give you more information. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Hello, I want to tell the anonymous listener in Scotts Valley who called in with the deleted file question.
Uh-huh.
The software data recovery, Recover My Files, go to recovermyfiles.com. That software does not write to your hard drive.
Okay.
So you can run it. You can preview deleted files. I would just recommend downloading the trialware, seeing if you can see the file or not, before you, that way you won't freak out. And then you can decide if you want to purchase it and get it back.
Sean, thank you very much for the answer.
Yeah.
Miles, thank you for joining us today. To both of you, I appreciate you being here every week to join us on Geek Speak. The geeks this morning, Sean Cleveland, Miles Elam. Sean Cleveland works at NVIDIA. Miles Elam works for Serve Control. And also answering our phones, Rick Philman, who I believe works up at the school up in Aptos, which of course is called Cabrillo. Rick Philman, for answering our calls, thank you very much. For you participating in GeekSpeak, it means a lot. And those listening and calling in, thank you so much for participating. Without you, it would just be us geeking out. And, who really wants to listen to that? GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computers and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. We have another minute of Geek Speak, so I'm going to ask one of you to fill for me a little bit.
You know what? I played with Vista this past week.
Oh, the new operating
Windows
system.
Windows Vista, the new operating system from Microsoft.
And
wow, it's amazing. You know, everything, the desktop, every GUI, every graphical window, it's all 3D based. Everything
Very cool.
is 3D. So you pretty much need a GPU, or a nice high-end video card to use the operating system. But if you've got something up to snuff, it's going to just be amazing. It's called Aero. To get the Aero functionality with all the great look, you got to have a nice video card. Otherwise, Windows is going to look like it does now. But we'll talk about it next week.
And also next week on Geek Speak, we're going to have Jim Sherhart on. We're talking about DVD archive and home entertainment. Not completely sure Jim's expertise on it, but I'm sure he is an expert. And, of course, we'll have a full contingent of geeks to answer your calls and questions. Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz, KBDH, San Otto, on the web at kusp.org. For KUSP and Geek Speak, I'm Lyle Troxell. Coming up next is Castle Cottage. But first, we're going to get a little bit of the Slow County Report. I appreciate you listening to Geek Speak, and I'll see you next week.